Chapter 7. And Oklahoma became the South. Dispersed from their countries of origin and perpetually homeless on this continent, African Americans have imagined into being a promised land that is located both within and outside the national boundaries of the United States. In the realm of the Black imaginary, then, the sight of the Indian has been present, persistent, and paramount. Taya Miles and Sharon P. Holland, Crossing Waters, Crossing Worlds. As exceptional as what happened to Cow Tom was, it's even more exceptional to learn that one of his relatives, another Black Creek man, would lead the Creek Nation years later and help found the town in which I grew up. When I was 7 years old, my family moved to Oklahoma from New York City. We moved to South Tulsa, which is what my grandfather would call Pilgrim, in other words, incredibly white. The private Christian schools my Jamaican parents put me in were even whiter, if that is possible. Tulsa can be cut five ways: North Tulsa, South Tulsa, East Tulsa, West Tulsa, and Midtown Tulsa. All of those parts except North Tulsa looked just as white as my school, or at least that's what I thought. We'd go to church, though, in North Tulsa, and in those churches, we'd find the very Black people we wanted to be around. My mother called them saved, sanctified folk. As a teenager, I had all but given up trying to learn about Black Tulsa. But that changed one Sunday in 2006. My father and I, to make extra money, had a large paper route where we delivered the Tulsa World in white neighborhoods. So I had my hand on the pulse of the news, at least Tulsa news, and usually before the news was widely circulated. That day, a headline on the front page caught my eye. "We don't deliver. Tulsa's North Side left out." According to the piece, Mark White, an owner of 10 Domino's pizza franchises in the Tulsa area, had essentially declared that he would not deliver pizzas to North Tulsa. The article quoted Sharisa McLennan, a North Tulsa resident who for years couldn't get a Domino's pizza delivered to her house. When she tried, she always got the same answer. "They say it's out of their service area," said McLennan. "You can't make anyone offer a service, but it has a bad suggestive undertone." What White did not know at the time was that the fear he had of North Tulsa in 2006 was directly tied to the racism in Tulsa from a century before. Perhaps if he knew this history, and that of Legis Perriman, he would think differently about North Tulsa and the people who live there. The Perrimans, perhaps the most racially and ethnically complex family in Oklahoma history, helped to found Tulsa, once called Tulsi Town. And a man whose status was both fully Black and fully Creek, Legis Perriman, once saw Tulsa far differently from how we see it today. No Oklahoma history class taught me about a Tulsa whose founders included a family, some of whom were white, some of whom were mixed, white and Creek, Creek and Black, white and Black, some of whom were slaveholders, and others who missed enslavement because of the traditions and legacies of the Creek. I didn't know that Legis Perriman was related to Cow Tom. I didn't know that the city's first post office was founded by a Black man, Legis's brother Josiah. I couldn't imagine a Tulsa through the lens that they likely viewed it through, living on land owned by them by virtue of their indigenous ancestry. Tulsa is a place whose legacy never quite leaves the city alone. Its history haunts it. It's been the setting for some of the more confusing episodes of racial violence in America. Black life in Tulsa was never simple, and certainly not as simple as we'd like it to be. The story of Cow Tom and his descendants in Tulsa invites you to figure out how your history can and will forever enable you to become. And perhaps most important, this city, Tulsa, and this state, Oklahoma, have been at times bastions for experimenting with innovative approaches for how to belong. But the story of Legis Perriman, a darker-skinned Black chief of the Creek Nation elected twice, is the story of how Oklahoma became that much more racist. And it was that racism that upended the hopes for a unique form of racial progress. The Oklahoma City law offices of Riggs, Abney, Neal, Turpin, Orbison, and Lewis called to tell me that Sharon Lindsay Scott was ready to talk with me about her case at 7 p.m. the next day. She was suing the Creek Nation and the U.S. Department of the Interior for kicking her out of the nation in 1979. I left Tulsa at 10 a.m. for a 7 p.m. meeting that was a little more than 100 miles away, yet somehow I found myself racing at the last minute to get there less than 5 minutes late. Why? On my way to Oklahoma City, I decided to take a detour. Instead of driving southwest, I drove southeast towards Haskell, Redbird, and a collection of other small towns you've never heard of. I went to Porter, population 566, which is known for its annual peach festival. I drove to Muskogee, Okmulgee, and when I finally got close to Oklahoma City, Spencer, Boley, and Slick. These were all black towns that harbored the histories of people like Cow Tom and Legis Pyramid. In them I got lost, not geographically, but historically. Redbird is 45 minutes away from where I grew up. In her book, Crossing Waters, Crossing Worlds, The African Diaspora in Indian Country, Taya Miles talks about a brochure from the Redbird Investment Company, owned and operated by black people who were awarded land from Indian allotments, which read, "A message to the colored man. Do you want a home in the great Southwest, the beautiful Indian Territory, in a town populated by intelligent, self-reliant colored people?" Early in the 20th century, Jason Mayer Connor, a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, attested to this when he wrote, "I have made a personal visit to the Indian Territory and know it to be the best place on earth for the Negro." Others said of this territory that this country is the paradise for the colored people. A 1904 article in the Muskogee Comet, a black newspaper, said of this area that it may verily be called the Eden of the West for the colored people. Another black newspaper in Kansas, the Afro-American Advocate, sounded the clarion call to black people across the South to come home, come home, come out of the wilderness from among these lawless lynchers and breathe the free air. The Oklahoma that the Perrimans knew was quite different from the Oklahoma I knew. For most of their lives, Oklahoma wasn't Oklahoma. It was Indian territory. The Perrimans were part of the black bourgeoisie precisely because they were in Oklahoma, the part of Tulsa that blacks settled, Booker T. Washington called Negro Wall Street. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote of this Negro Wall Street, "I have never seen a color community so highly organized as that of Tulsa. The colored people of Tulsa have accumulated property, have established stores and business organizations, and have made money in oil." And despite Mark White's 21st century perspective on North Tulsa, it was said in the early 20th century that this area was so economically self-sufficient that purportedly a dollar circulated within the community 50 times, sometimes taking a year for currency to leave the community. The Perrimans were part of this Eden of the West for colored people, and were free from these lawless lynchers. Here they could breathe the free air. In other ways, the Oklahoma that Legis Pyramid knew was similar to the one I knew, equipped with every level of race-based vitriol one could imagine. And the sin of white supremacy that begat America's original sin found its way into Oklahoma, what was once the Eden of the West for colored people. When I finally arrived in Oklahoma City, I met Sharon. I guessed that she stood no more than 5 feet 6 inches, but she'd be much taller if she stood on the thousands of pages she submitted to the Bureau of Indian Affairs to recognize what she's known all of her life, that Creek identity and tribe leadership run in the family. Sharon came to learn about being Creek, she told me, from my mother, Adeline Perryman Lindsay, because then in 1968, I remember them receiving checks from the Creek Nation. Back then, the Creek Nation provided payments to its members based on revenue generated from what was owed to the Creek Nation, land deals and earnings through other activities. The treaties, though they limited what stake the Creek Nation overall could claim, determined who was Creek and subsequently who qualified for these payments. Today, the Muscogee Creek Nation does not distribute per capita payments. Instead, the nation uses the funds it's paid for social services and healthcare for citizens. In fact, significant casino revenues are redistributed to education, social services, and healthcare assistance. But then it stopped, Sharon said. My mother, she had two sisters. They wondered why the check stopped. And of course they called the Creek Nation and they were told they were freedmen and they weren't entitled to the money. And of course everything's based on the roll number and they were considered freemen on the freedmen roll. Being a black freedman or being full blood Creek didn't matter to the Creek nearly as much as it mattered to the U.S. government, which came up with these distinctions more than a century ago. Sharon's mother and aunt, she recalled, wrote to the Bureau of Indian Affairs for them to find out as to what was going on actually getting them citizenship. Adeline, Sharon, and the rest of their family were left to do what black people have been doing for as long as black people have been in America, trying to make a home in a place whose welcome was never warm and whose initial invite was no invite at all. Belonging to the Creek Nation mattered so much to Sharon that in the early 2000s, she started the painstaking process of appealing again for the Creek Nation to recognize not just her, but her family's contribution to the nation. Hearing Sharon's story and reading about the political success of Legas Pyramid 100 years before reveal a painful truth. As the Indian Territory entered the 20th century, as it became Oklahoma, it became more blatantly racist, and the Creek Nation wasn't immune to that. In fact, the very treaty that assured people like Cowtom and his descendants a home in the Creek Nation, Sharon included, also decreased its tribal authority of the nation, which had the effect of legally marginalizing the nation's black citizen. Perhaps the most salient example of this could be found in the August 6, 1903 edition of the South McAllister Capitol, which said of Legas, "Old Legas Pyramid was sweating like a nigger." And outside the Creek Nation, Oklahoma was doubling down on bolstering its anti-black bona fides as it entered the Union in the early 20th century. On December 18, 1907, Senate Bill 1 was passed by the state Senate and signed by Charles N. Haskell, the first governor of Oklahoma. A month and 2 days before Senate Bill 1 was signed into law, Oklahoma was officially admitted to the Union. The Abbeville, South Carolina Press and Banner ran a piece announcing the news. The piece read, "With impressive ceremonies befitting the birth of the new state of Oklahoma, the oaths of office were administered to Governor Charles N. Haskell and other state officers a few minutes before noon. In one of the carriages were the chiefs of the 5 civilized tribes dressed as citizens, Indians and whites mingled in picturesque good fellowship. Some of the Indians wore blankets and some squaws carried papooses. At the Carnegie Library in Guthrie, Oklahoma, there was an allegorical marriage ceremony which joined Oklahoma and Indian Territory for life. C.G. Joynes of Oklahoma City, for many years one of the most tireless champions of joint statehood, was the bridegroom. He made the proposal of marriage to the bride, Miss Indian Territory, who was Mrs. Leo Bennett of Muscogee, a beautiful native of the Cherokee Nation and wife of Dr. Leo Bennett." The awkwardness of this report is obvious today. White men who settled the land then took away Creek control over the land they promised would be for indigenous people only, were then celebrated for making this sacred territory their land without permission. That is not just awkward, it is another promise broken. And instead of lamenting the breaking of the promise, observers call this a wedding between these Indian nations and this new state and the United States of America. Do you notice who was missing? There's a simple reason black lives are omitted from American history. The presence of black lives in our history always indicts white America for generating prosperity on the backs of its own people. Black existence and success shatter the illusion that Americans are exceptional and that our ascent has been attained without keeping some of us down. And for that matter, the presence of Indian nations indicts America just as much. So of course it had to be a wedding, to convey that the relations between Indian nations and this new state in the Union were normalized. To be clear, things were not normal. In Oklahoma, it started with Senate Bill 1, signed into law 1 week after this metaphorical marriage between Indian Territory and the state of Oklahoma, arranged by the will and ambition of white supremacy. As the first two governors of Oklahoma, Charles Haskell and Lee Cruz, were politicians who knew that explicitly excluding blacks from the political process would scuttle any chance of admitting Oklahoma as a state. Theodore Roosevelt was in the White House, and he was keeping a watchful eye on Haskell and his actions toward blacks. Roosevelt, a Republican and a progressive, was the same president who had invited Booker T. Washington to dinner at the White House, an event that led to the infamous poem, Niggers in the White House, that was circulated around the country. As a result, Haskell and Cruz kept their plans to doom black life in Oklahoma after it became a state. Senate Bill 1 was colloquially called the Coach Law and brought the scourge of Jim Crow formally within Indian Territory's borders. It was passed 95-10. The bill ensured that every railway company, urban or suburban car company, streetcar or interurban car or railway company would provide separate coaches or compartments as hereinafter provided for the accommodation of the white and Negro races, which separate coaches or cars shall be equal in all points of comfort and convenience. Following that section was one that mandated that each railroad depot must have separate, adequately signed waiting rooms for each race. If a depot didn't do this, the railroad company and depot manager could face a fine of up to $1,000, $28,000 today. And if passengers didn't listen to a conductor when they were in the wrong coach or compartment, they would have to pay $25, about $700 today. To soften the blow, the fines generated by the bill were earmarked for the state's common school fund, because who doesn't want dollars earned through racist means to go to white children? This bill was considered an emergency measure, which is why Senator H.E.P. Stanford abstained, refusing to vote because he didn't like that it was passed through the Senate as an emergency bill. Though not racially progressive, Stanford made it clear that he firmly stood with the law, clarifying that he had a problem with black nurses and attendants even entering white coaches. When the bill got to the House, only the Republicans still drenched in the Civil War sentiment of anti-slavery voted against it. I wondered how someone like Legis Pyramid could go over the course of his entire life from being chief of a nation to being remembered, as the famed Creek poet and journalist Alex Posey called him, as a nigger and a bad one at that. Posey aimed to stain Legis Pyramid's reputation by maligning his blackness. Blackness, or any racial identity, isn't inherently bent on being good or bad. Black identity becomes dangerous when Posey, or anyone else for that matter, decides that being black is inherently dangerous. For a man as accomplished as Legis to be reduced to that description is another example of how white supremacy holds unfettered sway in America. Legis had to be a nigger because it makes elevating white lives easier when there are black and brown lives to be stepped on. Angie DeBow described the Perryman family and also spoke to the family's curious admixture of black and non-black ancestry when she wrote, "The ablest and most prominent mixed-blood family in the nation had received a noticeable strain of Negro blood in its early history. The members of this family ignored this admixture without attempting to deny it, and associated themselves with white and Indian Creeks. And so great was the respect felt for their character and ability that they were freely accepted even by this proud and aristocratic group. But except for this one numerous family, the Negro-Indian admixture was confined to the Fullbloods." The Perryman family may confuse people. Legis was the nephew of Mose Perryman. Mose Perryman was one of eight children of Benjamin Perryman, who migrated to the area during the Trail of Tears and was one of the earliest settlers in the area. He eventually ran one of the larger plantations, worked by several enslaved blacks. Some of his slaves recalled how they always had plenty of clothes and lots to eat, and they all lived in good log cabins we built. But Legis Perryman had never been a slave. Lewis Perryman, a non-black Creek man, married Ellen Winslet, a black Creek woman, who too had never been enslaved. She gave birth to Legis in Sodom, now known as Tallahassee, Oklahoma, a former all-black town. Today, Lewis Perryman is considered to be one of the fathers of the city of Tulsa. Legis's brother would go on to found Tulsa's first post office and serve as its postmaster. Legis became a lawyer and served as a prosecutor and judge. He then was elected to a seat in the Creek Nation House of Warriors. Sharon Lindsay Scott's direct ancestors founded Tulsa. They did so as Tulsi Town. According to historians of the Brookside neighborhood, one of Tulsa's wealthiest neighborhoods today, the mixed-blood Creek Nation Perryman family was one of the first families to settle in this area and operated the first post office in 1882 at the home of George Perryman near what is now 41st and Trenton. Perryman himself served in the Union Army as part of the 1st Regiment Indian Home Guards. While his older kin, Cow Tom, led the Creek Nation, Legis and his brothers, Josiah and George, took up arms and fought for the Union during the Civil War. The Civil War was a pivotal time in marking and delineating color lines in the Creek Nation. It was because the mixed-blood Creeks fought in the Confederate Army that the full-bloods remained loyal to the Union. At least this was the contention made by Legis Perryman, who was chief of the Creek Nation from 1887 to 1895, and lived for many years near what is now Tulsa. It was Legis with whom Senator Henry L. Dawes of Massachusetts dealt when negotiating a treaty with the Creeks when the Dawes Commission was first established in Indian Territory in 1893. Although a full-blood Creek, Chief Perryman spoke English fluently and was as familiar with the history of white men in Indian Territory as he was with that of the Indians. He was one of the original claimants for a share in the Loyal Creek payment, a fund distributed by the federal government among Indians who had remained loyal to the Union during the Civil War. So Legis not only negotiated with Senator Dawes and what became known as the Dawes Commission, but also was loyal to the Union cause, and for that he received significant financial support from the federal government, eventually leasing his land in Tulsa that would pasture approximately 22,000 head of cattle for Texas ranchers. Before he died, ex-chief Perryman explained the attitude of the Creek Indians during the Civil War. He said the first Creeks who emigrated to Indian Territory, per the stipulations of its treaty with the United States, were part of what was known as the McIntosh Party, or mixed element. Full-blood Creeks were slower to leave their homes in the Southeast and didn't readily accept new conditions offered by the government, so they did not come to Indian Territory until 1832. This caused a breach between the two elements within the nations, prompting the mixed bloods to align against the full bloods in nearly every political struggle. At the start of the Civil War, the McIntosh faction allied with the Confederacy. The full bloods, being opposed to anything that the mixed blood element supported, joined the Union Army. This explained, according to Perryman, why nearly all the Creeks who fought for the Union were full bloods. Many mixed bloods held slaves before the war, while few full bloods did. This made it natural for McIntosh to support the Confederate cause. In other words, full bloods included people like Legis Perryman, who were both Creek and black. Blackness in Legis's eyes didn't contaminate his blackness or his Creekness. Mixed blood meant that you were mixed with white people and likely to be aligned with those who used slave labor and supported the Confederate cause. In Perryman's opinion, few Creek Indians joined the armies of the North and South for purely patriotic reasons. "I fought in both armies," said Perryman. "When the war broke out, I joined the Confederate Army. At the expiration of my term, I went home and thought no more of going into the army until I visited a Union camp near Flat Rock. The boys wore such nice uniforms and were so anxious to have me join as a scout in the Southern Army, and my experience there came in handy. We were stationed at Fort Gibson, and made raids from there on small bands of Confederates, but had no big battles. It was very dangerous warfare, for if the enemy caught you, it meant death. According to Perryman, the U.S. government sent proclamations to the chiefs of the five civilized tribes at the outset of the Civil War, asking them to take no part on either side of the struggle. The Indians were regarded as neutral, and the federal government did not want them to suffer loss of property as a result of the war. "But we just couldn't keep out of the war," Perryman said later. "We had heard the old Indians tell stories of valor and of brave deeds in wars with white men and with other tribes of Indians. A young man, until he had undergone the dangers of war, was not considered a complete citizen. The spirit of war had been so instilled into some of us that we were burning with a desire to ride a charger and face the bullets of the enemy. This caused most of the younger Creeks to take a hand in the war on one side or the other." When the war ended, the Perryman boys went back to Tulsa with their allotments and their earned Union loyalty dollars. Josiah and George to the Perryman business interests in and around Tulsa, while Legas went into law and politics. By 1868, he was elected to serve for 6 years as a district judge in the Coweta District. Before he was 40 years old, he left the bench and was elected to a seat in the House of Warriors, representing Big Springtown when his brother Sanford died. During his time, he also sat on the Creek National Council, and he was reelected 3 times after first getting his brother's seat. By 1887, Perryman was a household name in the Creek Nation, and won easily the role of principal chief. As principal chief, Perryman dealt with the U.S. government, including Senator Dawes and his commission members. He negotiated with white settlers and had a front row seat to the radical transformation of Indian territory, which was rapidly moving toward becoming a state. With large land holdings overseen by his family, his extensive business interests, and his family's political involvement in the Creek Nation, Legas was clearly part of a dynastic power family. So how did Legas go from being part of what could be considered a Creek political dynasty to being, as the New York Tribune quoted a political opponent in 1903, a sly old coon? And the opponent admitted, "I was mighty sorry old Legas got nominated, 'cause he ain't full blood," and he went on to use a slur which disparages Native Americans. How did a Creek chief, whose family for generations had been leaders in indigenous Oklahoma politics, become an old coon? Legas Perryman was asked by the House Subcommittee for Indian Affairs in 1906 to speak on the restrictions the federal government had placed on full-blood Creeks to sell land they owned. Perryman was a full-blood, according to the Dawes Rolls, also known as the Final Rolls. These are the lists of individuals who were accepted as eligible for tribal membership in the five civilized tribes, Cherokees, Chickasaws, Choctaws, Creeks, and Seminoles. However, the lists do not include those whose applications were stricken, rejected, or judged as doubtful. Perryman was restricted for 25 years by federal law from selling the land he owned. Being black, as well as being Creek, was a recurring problem for those who were both. In the United States, one drop of black blood made Perryman less Creek, less entitled to the rights and privileges of citizenship. Despite the other aspects of Legas's identity, Black Creek, lawyer, judge, landowner, leader, he was reduced to being labeled an old coon. And being labeled that in a time when Black codes, Jim Crow laws, and other codifications of white supremacy permeated every corner of life, Legas couldn't be anything else. White supremacists worked to confirm this definition. Toward the end of his time as chief, Legas became known in news outlets as sly, scheming, and corrupt. In the Guthrie Daily Leader of May 24, 1904, the insinuation that Perryman was unscrupulous was made clear. It read, "The loyal Creeks will soon receive the cash on their old war claims. The entire amount of the claim was $1,200,000. But after long years of waiting and many conferences between Indians and congressional committees, it was finally scaled to half that amount." The Indian most instrumental in securing the award was Honorable D.M. Hodge of Tulsa. For his services, he was allowed to retain 5% of the amount collected. This circumstance alone shows that the Indian but had little hopes of ever getting anything out of the government. The claim was pending more than 30 years. Ex-Governor Elsie Perryman will get a nice little slice. This is what happens when you're a black leader of an institution not considered suitable for black people, even if black people helped build it. Cow Tom and Harry Island had negotiated the very treaties that kept alive the hopes of black life in the Creek Nation. Cow Tom even led the Creek Nation when many in the nation were considered refugees within the United States. But today, more than 150 years later, black Creeks are still trying to convince the nation that they belong. Reporters from the Fort Worth Daily Gazette put it this way in 1887. These Indians cannot afford to quarrel and fight among themselves. If they expect to retain their tribal nationalities and existence, they must cultivate harmony among themselves. They must stand shoulder to shoulder. Avaricious whites stand ready to take advantage of all dissensions to promote discord, division, and the opening up of the country. In union and harmony only is there prosperity and political salvation. But before writers like Alex Posey hurled racist insults at Legis Perryman throughout his tenure as principal chief, plans were being hatched in the halls of white privilege. Senator Dawes, on the second day of the 1886 Lake Mohonk Conference, an annual meeting of wealthy white elites to discuss Indian affairs and make recommendations to the government, said, "When that time comes, there can be no reservation to abolish or to perpetuate, no Indian agent to appoint or dismiss, no treaty to keep or abrogate. The work is accomplished when the Indian has become one of us, absorbed into this body politic, a self-supporting citizen, and nothing is left of these questions that are troubling us." How did we get here? Who did this? Whose acts of seemingly benevolent white supremacy minimized Legis Perryman? The classifications of race that limited him and thousands of other black Creeks to imprecise ahistorical identities that plagued Legis's direct descendant Sharon and her mother Adeline in 1979 are faulty at best. And that's what Dawes did. As a white man elected to the U.S. Senate, who was given the responsibility of determining what the relationship between the federal government and Native nations should be going forward, he gave many non-whites identities that we never asked for, but that white supremacy required. These Creek roles are the work of Dawes, and his actions haunt Cow Tom's descendants today. Chapter 8, The Invasion of Dawes, Curtis, and Bixby II. The worst feature of the Indian service is that the Indian sometimes does not know what is best for him, and when he does know, 10 chances to 1, he listens to the wrong man. Henry Dawes. It is difficult to know true freedom when its boundaries are established by an oppressor. But that is the story of the Creek, and the stories of the black and the brown. The reason the Creek identity will always encompass the narrative of indigenous and black survival is that they share an oppressor. When I delve into the history of the five tribes, Henry Dawes' name comes up over and over. But behind Dawes was a man named Tams Bixby, who set in place much of the racism and white supremacy that black Creeks face today. And Bixby, like many other destructive people, with a benevolent veneer, has a town named after him, too. We might have thought that the work of civilizing had concluded with Benjamin Hawkins, but Henry Dawes saw it as his duty to instruct the Native Americans that the work of civilizing themselves was far from finished. Henry Dawes was the epitome of a Northeastern elite. Born in Western Massachusetts in 1816, he studied law at Yale, and at 32 was elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives. 2 years later, he was elected to the state Senate, and 3 years after that, he sat on the Massachusetts Constitutional Convention. He became a U.S. Senator in 1874 at age 58. Dawes was called by many white people of his time the friend of the Indian. But who was this man who forever changed the landscape of indigenous life in America and subsequently black life forever? While his career was distinguished on paper, it and he cannot be understood without understanding that he was more than anything a child of the age of scientific racism. Consider where America was at the time that Dawes came to national power. Not more than a generation had passed since the Civil War. Industry had picked up, railroads had begun to crisscross the land. Bit by bit, parts of the country that knew nothing of industry or capitalism were thrust into both. Immigrants by the millions poured into the country. People who once knew only how to till, sow, and reap found themselves moving away from the land to work in cities and factories. America was moving, and it was moving fast. In the eyes of many, humanity was progressing. Humanity was on part of its inevitable evolutionary pathway to improve, to get richer, move faster, live more comfortably. The assumption was that who we are now would be infinitely better than who we've been, and that who we can become would be orders of magnitude better than who and where we are now. Anthropologists, scientists, politicians, public intellectuals, and more got behind this concept that America, tattered though it may have been a handful of decades ago, was on the proverbial come up. But there was a problem with this idea. These advances were not experienced by everyone. In fact, a great many people in the United States, some of whose ancestors predated the presence of white people in America, were not progressing at the rate that people expected. For these civilized white people who thought America was destined for progress, there were stages to culture. Culture and cultural progress came in waves. According to social historian Frederick Hoxie, some of the leaders of the time thought that racial differences raised the barriers between stages of culture. Two of them, William John McGee and William Henry Holmes, studied ways that culture could be advanced. As Holmes put it, the final battle of the races for the possession of the world was at the time already on. Holmes accepted wholeheartedly that America would never be able to balance its teeming social progress with divergent paths of civilization and development between races, leading him to predict that there would inevitably be a fading out to total oblivion for people like Indians, whom he called savage and barbaric. Who was Holmes? Who was William John McGee? And why does either of them matter? Social progress was part of the appetite of Henry Dawes and the rest of the Dawes Commission, as was the belief that race and ethnicity were stumbling blocks to America's progress. People like Dawes believed that they could usher wayward blacks and natives towards civilization, white civilization. William John McGee was a self-taught geologist, an inventor, and the author of numerous books. He was part of the U.S. Geological Survey in an era when the United States was expanding. He studied earthquakes and presented his findings at expositions. He led the American Association for the Advancement of Science, or otherwise known as the AAAS, the American Anthropological Association, and the National Geographic Society, and he co-founded the Geological Society of America. His influence was, and still is, undeniable. McGee told the AAAS in 1897 about progress and the AAAS members' role in it as bringing order out of the vast chaos of action and thought which had so long resisted analysis and synthesis. So how could he explain why whites in America had persistently been much more successful than their non-white counterparts? Easily. There were different groups of humanity. In McGee's explanation, the progenitors of the white man must have been well past the critical point before the progenitors of the red and the black arose from the plane of bestiality to that of humanity, he wrote. In other words, the reason in the minds of people like McGee that white people have progressed so much faster than black or indigenous people is that they evolved faster than either group. And conversely, black people, for McGee, have not evolved as quickly because they were predisposed to slower progress, if they experienced progress at all. Black people are the cause of their own strife, Sound familiar? McGee added that progress was neither uniform, whites evolved before blacks, nor steady. The races of the world might be blending into a single entity, but this was occurring through the more rapid extinction of lower races. McGee went on to call America and its imperialistic appetite the lamp of civilization that shone bright on the dark-skinned peoples, and believed that not all of us barbarians could be saved. The story of progress for Black, Indigenous, and those who were both would come at the allowance of white men, if we were lucky enough to be, quote-unquote, saved. And saving was truly a matter of luck meeting opportunity. As McGee said in a speech to the Anthropological Society of Washington, the savage stands strikingly close to subhuman species in every aspect of mentality. The range from instinct and budding reason of higher animals to the thinking of lowest man seems far less than separating the zoomimic or animal-like savage from the engine-using inventor. The disposition of McGee mattered, and still matters, because it foundationally influenced how leading thinkers and policymakers framed policies that influenced who they perceived as savages. Policymakers like McGee, Dawes, and Bixby were hungry for a scientific validation of their savior complex. So they made Blacks, Indians, and Black Indians in need of salvation. As Dawes wrote, "It is a pretty hard thing to deal with the character of men who refuse to see what is the best thing for them. The worst feature of the Indian service is that the Indian sometimes does not know what is best for him. And when he does know, 10 chances to 1, he listens to the wrong man." This was scientific racism, and it fueled Dawes and others on the commission. McGee was supposed to lead the Bureau of American Ethnology, but instead William Henry Holmes was given the position. Holmes was a self-trained museum curator who went on to write about civilizing humanity. He wrote, "We are now able to foretell the fading out to total oblivion in the very near future. All that will remain to the world of the faded race will be a few decaying monuments, the minor relics preserved in museums, and something of what has been written." He believed that the fate of Indian culture would be left behind. In his writing, when he did refer to Blacks and Indians or Black Indians, he called them inferior and uncivilized. McGee and Holmes were not alone. A host of others also worked to perpetuate these ideas. In American Anthropologist, George Painter wrote that it is proverbially true that primitive people cannot stand an enforced civilization. No better example of this can be cited than that of the American Indians, who, even on their own soil, have resisted civil conditions unto death. Indeed, they seem almost incapable of existence apart from their primitive, normal barbarism. Even where they have, in small numbers, settled to the arts of civilization, this is usually of such crude order, and so much of their native habits and traditions are carried into it, that they can be at best said to be only partially civilized. Painter believed that the efforts of people like Benjamin Hawkins had failed, not because Hawkins and his friends were wrong for trying to eradicate the remnants of American Indian culture and society, but because they were doomed from the beginning. These people could not escape what Hawkins deemed their normal barbarism. In other words, the effort to make the Native American white had failed. For Painter, these efforts had failed so significantly that these tribes, in his words, seemed surely destined to ultimate extinction. But Painter wasn't done with his white lens survey of humanity, specifically the portions of humanity that sit on the margins. In 1919, Painter wrote in American Anthropologist that the Negro as a slave had a peculiar advantage over the Indian, in that he fell at once under the tutelage and compelling hand of the master race, already highly schooled in civilization. Thus, he was at once forced into a certain conformity with the fundamentals of a higher life, and its allied habits were speedily acquired. Under slavery, also, he was more comfortably clothed and systematically fed than he had ever been in his native country. Black people also benefited from slavery, Painter argued, because they got to learn how to be civilized up close by watching their white owners. These were the leading American thinkers of the day, white men who shaped America's national culture about the primitive. Their views fueled the nation's systemic white supremacy. This is how black people and indigenous people and black indigenous people became worthy of saving in white eyes. These ideas didn't save anyone. They actually hurt these people with a benevolent brand of white supremacy armed with charity, a dangerous and alluring oppression. But to do this well, they had to craft a race where one didn't exist. They had to reduce Indian nations to a race to subjugate them. And the way for America to do this to its own indigenous peoples was through blood. Barbara Fields, a historian, and Karen Fields, a sociologist, published a book in 2012 that helped us understand why thinkers like George Painter became convinced of the seemingly embedded differences between white people and nearly everyone else. Racecraft, to Barbara and Karen Fields, is the idea that differences between races are rooted in, their words, the eugenicist, biological racist notion that something, whether it is blood or genes, has created a set of scientifically distinct groupings of people. As Karen Fields said in an interview, racecraft encompasses the fact that the race that is pictured by the subjects as real, in fact, is not. It's made to be real and envisioned collectively as something real. People begin to think, I have a racial identity, I have a race. As a black person or white person, I have certain characteristics. I'm smart. I deserve to be at the bottom, and so on. These things are programmed into people through the activity of doing that first thing, the act that is ostensibly based on heritage, that puts somebody in his or her place. The faux science that undergirded racism was the notion that black people, Native Americans, and blacks who were also Native Americans were disposed to be evolutionarily behind. Karen Fields illuminates why an idea so distant from reality or any substantiated fact could ever take root. She wrote, "Racecraft shares characteristics with witchcraft, two in particular. First, there's no rational causality. Nothing fundamentally associated with being black or Native American or both could causally explain what people at McGee and others saw as less evolved. Fields refers to witchcraft because the women of the Salem witch trials had nothing about them that could causally explain why the men around them would describe them as witches." But she continues. Second, there's witting or unwitting reliance on circular argument. For example, blood serves as a metaphor of race, but is often taken as a feature of race, even by scientifically trained people. If everyone takes race for granted, there's no reason that scientists would wean themselves from doing the same. Race is the category they start and end with. So in the case of black people or indigenous people, their blackness and their indigeneity became enough of an explainer of anything that black people or indigenous people would do or have done to them. This is how people have invented and built racism. It is how racism becomes durable. For the leaders in the late 1800s and early 1900s who tried to reconstitute who should be American, race was the category they started and ended with. Some of Dawes' contemporaries took the approach that Black and Native lives weren't worth much. Dawes and others viewed their roles as reformers, believing these scientifically flawed people could be systematically improved. And it didn't just apply to Native Americans. It also applied to black people. Dawes once said that the Republican Party needed to deliver an embattled minority from tyrannical rule. In other words, black people needed to be saved from slavery. But once they had been saved from tyranny, Dawes focused on another group, America's indigenous people, specifically the Five Tribes. According to Kent Carter, an expert on Dawes' life and work, Dawes was no doubt sincere in his desire to help the Indians, but it's often the unrequested help that does the most damage. Dawes, in 1887, tried to push through the General Allotment Act, which would give Native Americans, as Angie DeBow put it, the perilous gift of American citizenship. What became known as the Dawes Act sought to divide indigenous, communally held lands. This forced these nations, according to historian Kent Blancett, to, as he wrote, assume a capitalist and proprietary relationship with property. Dawes believed that this legislation provided economic stability to reservation communities and promoted the process of assimilation. And what did that lead to? The act liquidated tribal lands while individual ownership further aided in the checkerboarding effect of many reservations. In other words, indigenous-held land in Indian Territory, which is now Oklahoma, got smaller by about 100 million acres. And the lands the nations formerly held, the federal government sold off to white settlers bent on making a profit mainly through ranching, farming, and leasing. Such helping had even more dire consequences. The Dawes Act sought to erode the sovereign power of tribal governments. Blancett shows that the allotments that were formerly communal turned private and led to bank foreclosures, confiscation by the Internal Revenue Service, and fraudulent lease arrangements. Ownership of these lands would be subject to courts where they often were subdivided into tiny parcels, insufficient to support the Indian, Black, and Black Indian owners. Perhaps the most insidious part of the Dawes Act is that it empowered the federal government to determine who would get what. As a result, the government got to craft a race. As Sandy Grand, a political scientist and expert in Native American and Indigenous studies, put it, the task of defining Indianness was assigned to the Dawes Commission, a delegation of white men who embraced the prevailing racial purity model, to express Indianness in terms of blood quantum. Blood quantum is a highly dubious measurement of the amount of Indian blood one has. In other words, quantum is a fraction of blood that is derived from the original enrollees of a tribe who were on tribal census rolls. The assumption was that those who were original enrollees were typically full blood quantum. But even today, the U.S. Department of the Interior issues an ID card called the Certificate of Degree of Indian Blood, or CDIB. And the blood quantum got its governmental start with Dawes, no matter how unscientific and unrelated to DNA it might be. So the way that blood quantum is calculated is by using tribal documents, and usually it's a tribal official or a government official who calculates it. As Grand goes on to say, since there was no scientific means of determining precise bloodlines, commission members often ascribe blood status based on their own racist notions of what it meant to be Indian, designating full blood status to poorly assimilated Indians and mixed blood status to those who most resembled whites. These designations are still in place today, barring the descendants of Cow Tom from what is owed them, their identity. Before the Dawes Act, the Creek Nation was a confederacy of different tribes and peoples, embracing and amalgamating in their own way, mixing cultures and identities, living with the peace and controversy that any sovereign nation with different types of people does. But as Barbara Fields and Karen Fields suggest, that's what racecraft does. It conjures the characteristics that are not actually tied to race, but are linked to it, to define race categories and their subsequent treatment. That was what Dawes' efforts gave us. Dawes crafted a race, one whose bounds were limited to what he and a group of white men thought this new Indian race would be, and how this newly crafted race could serve their interests. It was no longer tradition, heritage, honor, self-determination, and pride that wove these people groups together. This is why it is puzzling for you to hear today of people who were both Black and Indian. It seems contradictory because we have been taught that even a drop of Blackness can dilute whatever other elements of identity there are in people. Why? Back in the early 1900s, when the Dawes Commission was enrolling people, those with mixed freedmen and Indian parents were automatically enrolled as freedmen, just as Cal Tom's descendants like Jake Simmons Sr. were. And that drop of freedmen identity crowded out their traces of Indian blood. It stripped them of the identity of these Black people whose identities were forged in Creek traditions. Being both fully Creek and fully Black seems nearly impossible. And Dawes's work made it even more difficult for Cal Tom's descendants to be recognized as that. So how did we get here? And who helped Dawes help so many people? When the members of the Five Tribes made the long march across the Trail of Tears, they did it with the understanding that this would be the last time their land would be minimized and curtailed. But when racism and anti-Indigenous politics and the desire to maximize the white man's financial gains come together, past commitments loosen. At the end of the Civil War, as the federal government tried to consolidate its power in the South, while Blacks were freed from slavery, they were soon subjected to what were known as Black Codes. These restrictive state laws were enacted to restrain Black people's freedom and nearly guaranteed to land-owning whites the use of Black people as cheap, if not free, labor. While the number of Black elected officials in the South increased, there were limits placed on Black voting. Even Lincoln wanted to place limits on Black suffrage. In states like South Carolina, Blacks were hit hard with discriminatory tax penalties that pummeled their economic well-being. These codes sowed seeds for what would later become the laws and practices known as Jim Crow. This was happening while the federal government was trying to keep pace with the rapid development of the American economy, which was rebounding after the war. As burgeoning railroads brought people west, undiscovered lands, by white men, were prospected and explored, and every measure of past treaties was scrutinized. The railroad companies began to creep toward Indian territory, and with them came immigrants from the north and the east. Settling around railroad tracks, these people, soon to be encroachers, saw the vast undeveloped lands and the opportunities that previous generations had seen in the southeastern United States. But they also saw Blacks who lived among Indians, and some Indians who didn't want anything to do with some other Indians. That is where Dawes reappeared. He came to count, divide, and minimize non-white people in Indian territory. Friend to Native Americans, though he claimed to be, his intentions were clear and destructive. Perhaps Dawes, who by November 1, 1893, had retired from the Senate, and his commission comrades Meredith Kidd, a Democrat and former military leader, and Archibald McKinnon, a former Confederate commanding officer, had every intention of allowing the Five Tribes to civilize at their own pace. But Interior Secretary Hoke Smith, to whom the commission reported, had more strident ideas, which he expressed in a 25-page letter called General Letter of Instructions. Secretary Smith wrote to Dawes, "Success in your negotiations will mean the total abolition of the tribal autonomy of the five civilized tribes and the wiping out of the quasi-independent governments within our territorial limits. It means also, ultimately, the organization of another territory in the United States and the admission of another state or states in the Union." Where did Hoke Smith get this determination? Congress in 1870 started to allow railroads to crisscross the continent. Many of those tracks were put down in Oklahoma, and with them came, as one Cherokee put it, the intrusion of whites, which became not only easy, but almost spectacular. Kent Carter, author of The Dawes Commission and the Allotment of the Five Civilized Tribes, 1893 to 1914, wrote, that the five civilized tribes were inundated by white farmers, merchants, miners, railroad construction crews, speculators, whiskey peddlers, and a wide assortment of criminals attracted by advertisements promising great opportunities. The Creeks called these people intruders. Today, if they were brown, some would disparagingly call them illegal immigrants. Instead, we call them pioneers. Some called them what my alma mater calls them, Sooners. Numerous towns that had sprung up along the railroad lines presented a special problem, because almost all of their residents were non-citizen whites who insisted that they be given the right to buy the lots on which they had built homes, according to Carter. And how could white settlers buy such lots unless the United States removed the Indian hold on those lands? Senators came to visit Indian territory and concluded that the problems were not caused by white settlers, the very illegal immigrants who invited themselves into this Indian territory. It was somehow the fault of the Five Nations that they couldn't keep their houses in order. These senators argued in court that the current native land treaties were unfair to white people and said that the 300,000 uninvited whites living in Indian territory were sending their children to schools that were deplorable. In their view, it was the responsibility of these Native Americans to run schools that were of high quality for their white interlopers. These senators concluded that the Native American system of government cannot continue. It is not only non-American, but it is radically wrong, and change is imperatively demanded in the interests of the Indian and whites alike, and such change cannot be much longer delayed. The situation grows worse and will continue to grow worse. Hoke Smith's instructions were clear. The U.S. government was reducing the Indian territory even further, and Dawes came to reduce it further still for the Native Americans. Angie DeBose said that the United States had finally determined to break down the autonomy of the five tribes and erect a white man's state upon the ruins of the Indian governments. This was the moment that white men in America had been waiting for. The president at the time, Grover Cleveland, approved. But he wanted at least a modicum of consent from the nations and believed that Dawes was the best man to elicit that consent, emphasizing that they would not listen to anybody but him. Dawes alerted the nations that he was coming, and the nations and their leaders, one of them black, Legis Perryman, were vehemently opposed. All the while, Congress started to assume that tribal governments had to be reduced to nothing, because they had, as Colorado Senator Henry Teller noted, wholly perverted their high trust. They have demonstrated their incapacity to so govern themselves, and no higher duty can rest upon the government that granted this authority than to revoke it when it has lamentably failed. For Teller and others, these tribal governments were antiquated at best, and at worst they were stopping the overall progress of the United States. By 1894, Dawes and the commissioners tried to set up meetings with the Five Nations. Tribal chiefs, Legis included, refused for months to respond to letters. Eventually they did, for the same reason that negotiations happened in the past. Either you negotiated the means of your own destruction to slow its pace, or you refused and were overwhelmed by it. After meeting with tribal leaders, Dawes recommended in 1897 making order out of that vast chaos of action and thought which had so long resisted analysis and synthesis. And Dawes knew just how that order would come. Count and divide. How would this happen? Allotment. When the allotment bill was passed by Congress, it empowered Dawes and his commission to decide who would be Indian, to what degree people would be Indian, and who was not. Imagine white men coming to you and dictating what your customs and traditions should be on the land you own. They give you slavery, a practice you don't want, especially not in the form that they practice. After you realize that these white men are increasing in number, you come to understand that resisting outright is futile. So you negotiate, only to see that you can only slow the inevitable tide of civilization that will wash over you. These whites tell you to leave your homes and march hundreds of miles on a deadly odyssey that your descendants will one day barely learn about in school. You go with the explicit understanding from the president that you and your nation will never have to move again, that you will never have to be displaced again. But a civil war happens around you and the world comes apart. Some of you are conscripted to fight, some of you on both sides, forcing you to learn the delicate dance of diplomacy. The war ends and the world is in chaos. Again, white men illegally enter your lands and demand that you educate them and make your land and your governance familiar to them, no matter how it inconveniences you. Now comes the final invasion. As Dawes aged and his health faded, the question arose, who could replace this man who oversaw the radical contraction of Indian territory? It must be someone who could further civilize the Native American in the 20th century. His name was the name of a city less than a mile from where I grew up. Henry Dawes may have given the commission its name, but Tams Bixby defined its character and would serve as its leader during the critical period of enrollment and allotment, Kent Carter wrote, and he would make the daily decisions that affected the life and future of all of the people in Indian Territory. And not long before that, when people wrote to the commission, they'd often address it to the Dawes-Bixby Commission. Tams Bixby became so popular that land promoters named a town site after him, and some parents even named their children Tams, probably in hopes of ensuring a favorable decision on their enrollment applications. By the end of the 1890s, as Dawes was gliding into old age, Bixby and others on the commission were busy implementing the Dawes rolls, an even more bastardized census to count who in the eyes of the U.S. government was a citizen of the Five Nations, who wasn't, and how much land people would get. Many Creeks did not want to participate in the census, so the commission team relied on the word of town kings akin to city managers, small town mayors, or city councilors, and their friends and relatives. Imagine entrusting a mayor or city manager to attest to your identity. But when a hunger for making money from the eventual sale of land that people weren't supposed to own in the first place is the primary lure, people will use any means necessary to run over the marginalized for their own benefit. It wasn't long before the commission's leader began to receive letters from people from all over the United States asking how they could get on the rolls so they could get Indian land. Armed with the threat that they could do this with or without indigenous help, the Dawes Act was amended by the Curtis Act. Passed in 1898 and signed into law by President William McKinley, the Curtis Act broke up the sovereign governments and lands of the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Creek, and Seminole. Initially, the Five Nations were exempt from the 1887 Dawes Act because they had treaties with the United States that predated that act. But throughout America's history, treaties with marginalized people have invariably been broken by white men. And break those treaties, the government did. Creek Chief Ispar Hetcher and the rest of the Creek National Council received notification that the United States hoped to enroll members of their nation, to place them on a roll created by the U.S. government that the nation would then use. Ispar Hetcher rebuffed it, saying that his nation was astonished by the suggestion and that Congress's granting the commission the authority to create rolls of his nation's citizens was tantamount to a grave violation of numerous treaty pledges made each of the Five Nations in oft-time repeated treaties. Each of the Five Nations balked at the audacity of the United States to oversee the tribes determining of who would be Indian and who would not. And you cannot blame them. It's like the United States invading another country and then telling that country who could be a citizen and who could not. As Kent Carter remarked, it is clear that some Creeks thought their tribal government could still negotiate with the United States as an equal, but they would soon learn that the federal government was not prepared to take no for an answer. Some of the Creeks employed a strategy of ignoring the commission, much to their detriment, as the tribal rolls kept growing without their consent or consultation. So then came the Curtis Act, which wrested control of the enrollment process away from the nations and placed it firmly in the hands of the U.S. government. The act gave control of determining nation's citizenship to the Dawes Commission. As a result, the Dawes Commission could now, without tribal consent and approval, dictate who was going to be Creek, sometimes resorting to eyeballing the complexions of applicants as a means of determining citizenship. With the loss of control of the nation's citizenship rights, also came the eradication of the nation's courts, conventions of tribal governance, and communal land claims that once existed in Indian Territory. This change helped to accelerate Indian Territory's becoming Oklahoma and the flood of white men profiting off land once held by Creek families. The Dawes Commission created a freedmen role, which included all of the people who looked like the Dawes Commission's surveyors to be a drop too black to be considered Creek. Before the freedmen role, all Creek members, freedmen or not, were entitled to the same rights. Yet the Dawes freedmen role made people like DeMario Solomon Simmons and his family too black to be Creek. And so began another long struggle. When racecraft takes hold, it gives permission for people to turn on each other. Pleasant Porter replaced Legis Perryman as chief and began to hurl similar vitriol against his Black Creek brothers that white men directed toward black people. Chief Porter testified before the Senate in 1906 and said of the freedmen that they had come forth from the four quarters of the earth and employ a lawyer here to assist them, and they and the lawyer will get up the proof that slides them through, and on the rolls they go. It is as slick as grease. Even the term freedman was damaging. Legis Perryman was a black man who'd never been enslaved and who had led the Creek Nation. But by making him and his family freedmen, the Dawes Commission anchored the Perryman's identity to one that may have never been theirs. The same can be said of DeMario's family, who to this day believes that Cow Tom was never a slave. But their identity claims, their history, and their ability to determine who they are continue to be shackled by the term freedmen. Labeling these people as freedmen did what the scientific racists needed. It created a category of people who were saved from the scourge of slavery by the so-called courageous help of elites who saved black people from the hell those elites had helped to create. While there is much more to Dawes's effect on life in Indian Territory, this much is clear. His involvement led to a wound from which Creeks would never recover. His actions were a clear expression of racism and racecraft in America, and they found their way inside one of the few places that had been able to keep at bay the marginalization of black people.